This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
In Ukraine, the military takes back a huge chunk of its country in a matter of days.
It looks to me more like a rout than an orderly retreat. Orderly retreats don't generally involve leaving huge numbers of tanks and armored vehicles and supplies.
Also today in Sweden, a far-right party makes some big gains. The main election focus, a rise in crime, even though most Swedes are not actually impacted.
But what we have seen is a growing perception that the government and the police have been losing control.
The far-right is blaming immigration for that. I'm Marco Werman, plus a hot new gift in China, paraphernalia with a green QR code on it.
If you get the yellow or red, then you're in trouble.
You see, in China, green is the color of a negative COVID test and a passport to freedom. All that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thanks for joining us at the start of the week. Some major developments in Ukraine over the weekend. Ukrainian forces retook nearly all of the northern region of Kharkiv after a stunning advance. Russian troops retreated from dozens of towns and villages. Chris Doherty is with us to break things down. He's a military analyst and senior fellow at the Center for a New American Security. Chris, what is your reaction to Ukraine's victory in the Kharkiv region? Were you surprised it happened so quickly or seemingly quickly?
Absolutely. And I think, in all honesty, the Ukrainians are probably surprised it happened as quickly as it did based on their planning. What we have seen is advances that are so fast and a collapse of the Russian forces in the sector that's been so catastrophic that I would imagine that by the time this goes to air, we'll probably see even further gains on the part of the Ukrainians. And what we're talking about now will be outdated. That's how quickly events are unfolding, both on the Ukrainian side in terms of how fast they're moving, but also on the Russian side of how fast they're withdrawing in what can only really be described as a rout along this entire front.
So you say a rout. Some are saying Russian troops simply retreated. What do you think is accurate?
Rout, retreat, the line between the two can be somewhat hard to discern. I think based on how fast they retreated and how much equipment they seem to have left behind and how many forces have been captured, it looks to me more like a rout than an orderly retreat.
So what details do you have about what actually happened on the ground? Like, do you have a general sense of how this unfolded and how long it took for Ukraine?
Based on the open source reporting, what we saw initially was a Ukrainian buildup in and around Kherson, which I know we're now talking about Kharkiv, which is on the other side of Ukraine. But it's important to think about this because that buildup and the messaging of that buildup caused Russia to move a lot of its most well-trained and well-equipped forces down to the Kherson region. And because Russia is operating on what we call external lines, and what that means functionally is if you're operating on internal lines, it's very easy to move from the center of a circle to any point on that circle. But if you're on the outside, that means you've got to go all the way around the circle to get to where you want to go. And so that circle of the front from roughly Kherson up to Kharkiv is very, very long, and it's even longer for the Russians. So if they want to move forces, it takes a lot of effort and a lot of time. So by drawing those forces down into the Kherson region with this offensive that the Ukrainians have launched there, they caused the Russians to weaken the front in Kharkiv to reinforce Kherson.
So essentially then, did Ukrainian forces dupe Moscow into thinking they were going to try and recapture the south of Ukraine?
I'm of the opinion that these were probably two planned assaults. The question I really have in my mind was just how much was the Kharkiv offensive really meant to be a full offensive that achieved this level of breakthrough? Or how much of it was meant to, as the Germans used to say in World War I, punch a hole and see what develops?
Chris, how is Russia framing these losses? What does it look like from their side?
So what we can see in Russian media and on Russian social media is, you know, I think almost a level of dumbfoundedness. Just as we're a little bit surprised at the speed and the effectiveness of this Ukrainian offensive, I think they've been shocked by just how badly pushed back that they've been. I think that there was a period of time, especially during the opening debacle of the Russian invasion, where there was a sense of denial, and you still see some of that, right? There, you know, there's this, well, it was just a feint and all this sort of fantastical thinking. I think now, however, the depth and breadth of Russian failures are actually starting to creep into public narratives inside Russia in ways that perhaps they didn't before.
For months, supporters of Ukraine have been eager to see a turning point in their favor. But what's a reality check, Chris? I mean, what difference does this weekend make to the overall direction of the war?
I think it makes a huge difference. I think that the alteration in the political dynamic in favor of Ukraine caused by this offensive really can't be understated. We were facing a long winter without, you know, adequate energy supplies, whether it's in the Europeans or in Ukraine, which imports its energy from Europe. And there was a lot of skepticism about the Ukrainians' ability to actually go on to the offensive and change this from a bloody stalemate into a successful operation. And if that wasn't going to happen, I think we'd probably see a gradual diminution of political support in the West. And what this has done is completely changed that dynamic, because now you can see a real path to victory, not just a stalemate that bloodies Russia at the cost of Ukrainian lives and Western weapons, but a real potential to retake territory up to and beyond the lines that were set in 2014.
Chris Doherty is a military analyst and senior fellow at the Center for New American Security. He's been speaking with us from Washington. Chris, thanks very much. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.
While some Russian forces are retreating from northeastern Ukraine, others are striking back. They're hitting critical infrastructure in the strategic city of Kharkiv. Nika Volkova is there. Nika, what's your life been like in Kharkiv the past few days?
We was out of electricity last night and out of water as well because of Russian bombing. And our emergency services and utility services fixed all this problem. The city came back to normal life, and Russia bombed this infrastructure again today in the afternoon, and it was again out of electricity like most of the city.
Yeah, there was a total blackout for all of Kharkiv last night. So this morning, when you went out to do errands, what did you see? What happened?
All the public transport worked. People went to work because they still continue living their life here. But at the afternoon, it was big shelling here. A few bombs in the city center and out of electricity again.
Another blackout. Now, during the day, one detail that really caught my eye was what the blackout meant for traffic in Kharkiv. I mean, this is a fairly big city with many roads. The traffic lights are often out. And what was it like today?
Yeah. The drivers at the crossroads with traffic lights out, they managed to support each other. And it wasn't some collapse or traffic jams, because they just regulated this traffic by themselves.
Nika, how common is it for the electricity to go out in Kharkiv?
It is not common. I think that last time I remember such total blackout, maybe in 90s, when we had some energetic problems in Ukraine, but it was almost 30 years ago.
Right. So it's been a while. I mean, when those bombs started falling again today and then another blackout, I mean, is that scary for you, given how infrequent it is?
Yeah, it's scary. And I think that the main goal of Russia here, they just trying to make us afraid of them or something like that, trying to make us panic. But people here in Kharkiv, they are so strong and brave. We are sure that we can do it. And there is no panic at the city now. And I'm really proud of it.
Well, not only have there been blackouts, but water, as you pointed out, also gets periodically cut off. How often does that happen? And how do you get by when there's no water?
Actually, me, I didn't have water. I wasn't prepared for that. And that's why I was happy that in 3 hours, 3 or 4 hours, water was back in the building. And I was pleasantly surprised by it. Mm. Then I just prepared some bottles with water for future if it happens again.
You don't usually reside in Kharkiv. Your home is in Western Ukraine, but your father lives in Kharkiv. I'm wondering how hard was the decision to go to Kharkiv to be with him and put yourself in the middle of this conflict?
It was scary for me, like, because I know that it's bombing here, but I need to visit my father because he got COVID, and I need to be here to support him. He's recovering now, and he sounds better.
Nico, what do you make of the news of these military advances by Ukraine this weekend? Are you hearing reports of liberated cities?
Yeah. We are really happy to hear this news, but we still understand that we will need to protect these areas and to be strong for some times to keep them.
Nika Volkova is living in Kharkiv in northeastern Ukraine. It's where she's been speaking with us from. Nika, thank you very much and be safe.
Thank you.
It's hard to believe it's been 3 years, but that's how long it's been since the seeds of the pandemic first emerged in China. Today, COVID restrictions remain very tight there. Travel options are limited, and when just a few positive cases are discovered, big public events are canceled. One more enduring COVID policy in China is the widespread use of QR health codes. From Shanghai, The World's Rebecca Canther explains how these green codes have taken on a whole new meaning in China.
In cities across China, to get into almost anywhere, subways, office buildings, restaurants, even vegetable markets, you need to show a green QR health code on your phone. Once you pull up the code, a machine scans it, and another symbol shows up on your phone. This time, it's a big green circle with an arrow on it. That's your proof that you've tested negative for COVID-19 and you can be out and about. To keep the green code, you need to keep getting tested. Carol Tang lives in Shanghai and gets tested every other day.
If you get the yellow or red, then you're in trouble. So green means you can go anywhere else. You get the freedom.
Tang's company runs big trade shows, but she's had events canceled at the last minute. The green code sort of rules over people's lives here. You need it to get on a plane or a train, to send your kids to school, even to use a public restroom. No one likes the policy and everyone grumbles about it, but there's no way to get around it. Now, the green code symbol is showing up in some unexpected places too. On stuffed animals, keychains, takeaway coffee, and cell phone cases. Marketing analyst Tracy Dai says it's become sort of a good luck charm.
It just means you good health in general. It can also mean, like, you know, you have the green QR code with you all the time, right? So definitely a good sign to say you stay negative in COVID test.
In China, the word for green code, liuma, sounds just like another word, green horse. So you guessed it. Green horses have also gone viral on social media. Carol Tang says a colleague brought desserts shaped like green horses to work one day. Everyone got the joke.
Yeah, they were happy to see that. Yeah, they definitely will be laughing. So green color is really the lucky one for our business.
Green horses have been popping up in public artworks and advertisements around China. There are even songs about green horses. Jiang Tian, a dad in Shanghai, bought matching green code t-shirts for his wife and two kids after surviving a 2-month-long lockdown earlier this year. The front of the shirt has a green horse. The back has a green code. When he and his family wear the shirts on the street, he says, everyone asks where they can get one too. But he says he doesn't see this trend as simply a gag. It's dark humor, Zhang says. It's a way of finding some joy amidst all the frustration that many people here feel. There's nothing we can do about the COVID policies, he says, but the shirts give us a little happiness. And in China these days, happiness comes in the form of a little green horse. For The World, I'm Rebecca Canther in Shanghai.
We'll be right back. You're listening to The World.
Support for The World comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is the only software your business will ever need. Featuring a suite of integrated business applications, Odoo connects your business operations together so you can get more done in less time. Odoo has apps for everything: CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, marketing, manufacturing, you name it, Odoo's got it. To learn more, visit odoo.com/the world. That's odoo.com/the world.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. The late Queen Elizabeth II is now lying in state in Edinburgh. As her admirers mourn her passing, there's a lot of logistics to work out, both at home and in what are called the realms. Those are the Commonwealth nations that look to the Queen as their head of state. Citizens in those countries, from Australia to Jamaica, are now reflecting on what relationship, if any, they want to maintain with the crown moving forward. Jerry Haddon reports.
Britain's now undergoing full-on royal rebranding. From changing postage stamps to rewriting church hymns, there are flags to refinesce, pounds to print. To wit, where once there was Charles's mum, we'll now see Charles.
And to my darling mama, I want simply to say this. Thank you.
14 out of 56 Commonwealth nations still recognize the British crown as head of state. Should they stay the course, accepting King Charles and, by turn, his image, they'll need to start minting new money too. But some are saying, hold on, do we even want to continue this colonial-era relationship founded on oppression? The Caribbean nation Barbados has already said no.
Possessing a clear sense of who we are and what we are capable of achieving, in the year 2021, we now turn our vessel's bow towards the new republic.
Last year, Barbadian Prime Minister Mia Mottley took control of the world's newest republic. While she was at it, she crowned a new national hero, Barbados-born pop star Rihanna.
May you continue to shine like a diamond and bring honor to your nation.
Rihanna trumping the royals. Still, Queen Elizabeth, ever gracious, sent her congratulations, along with her son, Prince Charles. At the ceremony, Charles apologized for Britain's atrocities during the colonial period, referring to the era of slavery as the darkest of days. It was a milestone moment, and the royal family tried to capitalize on it, sending the Queen's grandson, Prince William, and Kate Middleton, this year, on a Caribbean tour.
No! No! Apology! No!
The royals were met with cheers and protests and calls for reparations for slavery. In Jamaica, human rights activist Kay Osborne told Global News their visit was an insult.
For these young people to be here to try to persuade us to keep the status quo in place when our goal is to loosen and remove the hands, the gloved hands of the Queen from around our necks so that we can breathe.
Later, Jamaica's Prime Minister Andrew Holness warned William publicly of their looming breakup. Polls suggest only a quarter of Jamaicans support the crown as head of state, and many see the Queen's passing as a chance to shed that yoke. Neighboring nation Antigua and Barbuda has already pledged to hold such a referendum within 3 years. All of this is a far cry from the warm welcome Queen Elizabeth II would get on her visits to the Caribbean in the 1960s and 70s. It's been perhaps the force of her character and charisma that's kept the crown at the helm of so many Commonwealth countries for this long. Take Australia. Here's former Prime Minister David Turnbull the day after the Queen's death, recalling how she'd once given him her portrait as a gift.
And she said, with a wry smile, she said, "Here you are, you can put them in a cupboard, I suppose," which was charming and funny. And last night, as we were filled with such dread, I took the portrait of the Queen out and set it up. And we just thought, what an amazing life. What amazing leadership.
Turnbull teared up at the memory. Yet back in 1999, he put his full support behind a national referendum to leave the royals behind. It failed. Following the vote, he said that Australia's heart had been broken. Heartbroken, tied to the crown, heartbroken by Elizabeth's death. The contradictory feelings, the distinction between person and palace, ran strong while the Queen lived. Now that Elizabeth is gone, more Australians are quietly calling to cut the royal cord. It falls to King Charles now to convince them, and the remaining nations under his reign, to stay the course. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon.
As we reported on the show last week, Somalia is facing its worst drought in more than 40 years. The United Nations is warning that a famine could be around the corner. Drought is nothing new to Somalia, but the government there has never had a ministry to deal with environmental crises. Until now, the country's new president has appointed its first minister of environment and climate change. The world's Halima Gikandi recently sat down with her in Somalia's capital, Mogadishu.
I meet Minister Khadija Mohamed Al-Maksoumi at her home in Mogadishu. Because her ministry is still new, she doesn't have an office yet. But Al-Maksoumi tells me she's ready to get to work.
In Somalia, this is the first time in having a minister of environment and climate change. And the reason that the president has established this ministry because of the problem and the situation that people are suffering in Somalia, humanitarian issues and disaster, is climate change. It's affecting so many areas in Somalia.
This latest drought, she points out, has driven a million people from their homes due to lack of food. That's the immediate challenge for Somalia's government. But Al-Maksoumi says the root of the problem is clear.
The world, they think the only problem that Somalia have is security issues and security problem. And Somalia have a biggest problem now we're facing is climate change. And a humanitarian problem that we have now behind it is the climate change. And especially the impact as well is in Africa. We need to take it seriously.
In the past, Somalia has dealt with environmental crisis by relying heavily on humanitarian support from the international community. It often arrives when things are already severe. Al-Maksoumi says that needs to change.
This is the main reasons that the government of Somalia has established this ministry, because it was too much. For every year, we have humanitarian disaster problems, and the people tired. And the people, they cannot no more running from the hunger.
One of the first things on Al-Maksoumi's to-do list is a fact-finding trip around the country. She also wants to raise international awareness of the situation in Somalia.
Globally, everyone is talking about the climate change, but nobody's talking about how Somalia have the impact about the climate change. And this is the reality, but we need everyone to see Somalia facing climate change, big time issue. And a big time is a problem. So we need to have support in that area.
She says that support could come in the form of infrastructure projects and financing to help people adapt to the changing environment. Food and water insecurity caused by frequent droughts are another big concern. But humanitarian aid in the long run is not enough, Al-Maksoumi tells me.
Yes, Somalia needs humanitarian aids now, and this is urgent. But the question we need to know, why every year humanitarian problem that we get in, very simple, is the climate change. We need to concentrate how can we fix the issue of the climate change in Somalia. The rain that's supposed to be coming, it doesn't come. This is the main fact. And if we don't respond now, it will have more disaster and more issue will come up later.
That's the message Al-Maksoumi says she plans to bring to Egypt when she attends the United Nations Climate Conference in November. For The World, I'm Halima Gikandi, Mogadishu, Somalia.
Listen up this week for more of Halima's reporting from Somalia about the drought that is driving the country toward famine. More stories from around the globe are coming your way just ahead. You're listening to The World. UK Prime Minister presents a new cabinet that has shattered a historical norm, no white men at the top. Still, some question just how much diversity Britain's new leadership really represents.
It's not just about your background, it's about what you stand for and what you believe in. True diversity is not just about where you come from, it's about where you want to take the country.
That's coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. The long rule of Sweden's Social Democrat Party might soon be coming to an end. Votes are still being counted from yesterday's general election, and the results are razor thin. But what is clear is that a far-right anti-immigration party has gained ground. Journalist Dominic Hind has been following the election from the city of Malmo in southern Sweden. You've been speaking with Swedes, Dominic. What have been the issues that mattered to them in this election?
Many people are struggling with high energy prices and with inflation due to the war in Ukraine. But the media and the public debate has been absolutely dominated by the discussion around gang violence and crime in Sweden's cities. This is not really an issue that actually affects most people on a day-to-day level. The majority of Swedes live in very low crime, very safe neighborhoods, small towns. But what we have seen is a growing perception that the government and the police have been losing control over the crime rate and over criminal gangs. The far right and conservative parties have tried very hard to link the behavior of these gangs to migration and also particularly to Islamic migration, which has been relatively high in Sweden over the past decade or so.
So as votes are still being counted, we've seen a far right party, the Sweden Democrats, not to be confused with the government, the current government of the incumbent Social Democratic Party. The Sweden Democrats made some big gains in this election. What is their platform and their appeal?
I was in a small town in central Sweden last week and saw the party secretary of the Sweden Democrats, a guy called Rickard Jomshof, give a 1-hour speech to a square of applauding supporters in which he said that Islam was an inherently violent religion incompatible with Swedish values.
Wow.
And I think this tells you a lot about where the party is and what their core ideas are. Now, to give your listeners some context, the Sweden Democrats began in the early 1990s as an electoral vehicle for a range of far-right and neo-Nazi activists. They have increased their numbers again and again and again until yesterday we saw them hit 20% for the first time and be in a position to join a coalition government with the traditional conservative parties. The thing that has propelled them to this position is obsession with low petrol taxes or low gas prices, cutting taxes for the average person, but also a very, very hardline anti-migrant and particularly anti-Islam ticket.
I mean, more broadly, we're seeing the rise of far-right populist parties from France, Italy, and now Sweden. What's spurring this, and does Sweden fit the pattern?
Sweden very much fits the pattern of far-right growth across Europe. What you've seen is a process of normalization. We can see that there are politicians and parties around Europe. Also, the Alternative for Germany, the AfD in Germany, have been very successful in recent years. All of these parties have links with one another. And when you look at how they are operating, they are all following a very similar playbook, which is that they are taking disenfranchised working class voters, but also increasingly speaking to middle class voters who voted for conservative or right liberal parties and bringing them on board to form these very, very strong and increasingly vocal and powerful national movements, which threaten not only their opponents on the left, but also the liberal political center, which has been a cornerstone of politics in Sweden and elsewhere in Europe.
So following yesterday's election, Sweden's Prime Minister Magdalena Andersson has not resigned, which kind of points to just how close the vote is. Mm. When will we know the results and how the actors will attempt to carve out a ruling coalition?
Well, the Swedish parliament has an odd number of seats, so there's no chances of a tie as such. The reason that Magdalena Andersson has not conceded the election yet is that there is an outside chance at the time of recording that she may still pull through. But also, there is a discussion to be had about whether or not the public do want a government with the Sweden Democrats in. Now, I think what is important to understand is that this is not a defeat for Magdalena Andersson per se. Her vote share actually went up compared to the last time around for her party. Mm. The problem was that her alliance partners in the Left Party, in the Green Party, and the Centre Party, which is a very farming-influenced party from rural Sweden, all failed to make the same progress they had hoped. And that is what has given the far right and the right this very narrow majority at present.
So one final thing, Dominic, the incumbent Social Democrat-led government led by Prime Minister Andersson is also the one that applied to join NATO this year alongside Finland. If the government does move to the right, how could that impact Sweden's future in NATO?
I don't think a move to the right will necessarily impact Sweden's future in NATO at all. The right of Swedish politics has always been much more pro-NATO and pro-America than the left. I think in terms of foreign policy, the biggest differences we would see with a new right government is a much more robust approach to things like European integration, but also an interest in cooperating with regimes and with countries and with political movements that Sweden until now has strayed well away from. And as I hinted at earlier, if you think about what message it sends to countries around the world to have these radical right politicians in government in Sweden, that is really going to affect the image that Sweden projects overseas as well.
Journalist Dominic Hind is in the Swedish city of Malmo in southern Sweden, updating us on the latest in that country's general election yesterday. Dominic, thanks very much for taking the time.
Thank you.
To say the UK is in a time of transition is putting it mildly. There is the passing of Queen Elizabeth II and the arrival of a new prime minister, Liz Truss. Truss has assembled her cabinet, a historically diverse one. It looks like a clear break from long-held traditions there, but writer and political activist Taj Ali points out that diversity is about more than skin color and your background. We reached him last week in Luton, just north of London.
This claim obviously stems from the fact that for the first time in British history, none of the four most senior ministerial positions have been taken up by a white male. So I guess on the surface level, yes, it is a diverse cabinet. But if we look at the socioeconomic side of things, the vast majority of the new cabinet have been privately educated at fee-paying schools. The majority of people in this country, 93% of people in the UK, attend state schools. And we have a disproportionate number of our ministers in government from private schools. So there is a class divide. And I think that's a massive part of the equation when we talk about diversity.
Right. I mean, you recently tweeted that just 7% of Brits are privately educated, yet 74% of the new cabinet are privately educated. Why was that an important thing to point out in terms of social class?
I think often in the discussions around diversity, we kind of stick to this kind of superficial understanding of what diversity means, simply having people of color in positions of power or more women in positions of power. And very rarely do we talk about their socioeconomic background.
So let's talk specifically about social class and how the new cabinet sees it in policy terms. Kwasi Kwarteng, for example, the new chancellor, the finance minister, he's saddled with the problem of out-of-control inflation, a steep rise in fuel prices. What can we surmise about his approach to economic challenges faced by Britain's poor and working classes?
I think the cost of living crisis right now is such a major issue in this country. You know, people cannot afford to heat their homes. Fuel prices are going up. Inflation's in the double digits. And Kwasi Kwarteng is, of course, very close to Liz Truss ideologically. They are on the right of the Conservative Party. They want to see a greater kind of sort of free market role in the economy. And they're committed to tax cuts. And that would, of course, put them on a collision course against the Bank of England. So I think as a result of any proposed tax cuts, we're likely to see interest rates rise. And when interest rates rise, it's going to be very difficult for people to afford a mortgage. Renting becomes more difficult. People in debt will be struggling. I think it will get far worse for the poorest and most vulnerable in society.
So despite the fact that Mr. Kwarteng's parents are from Ghana, I mean, they are professionals, barrister and economist, I see, and he's black, you're saying he actually shares little experience in common with the majority of black Britons. I mean, what does diversity mean in the UK?
For me, diversity really and truly means encompassing not just gender, not just race, but also class. The vast majority of people from an ethnic minority background in this country are working class. So I think this is really, really important here. We are not just interested in token representation. We are interested in people who, you know, through policy will help people of color, will help people from working class backgrounds. And we cannot allow ourselves to kind of get bogged down in just mere superficial changes at the top.
I could imagine, Taj, a response from this cabinet to some of your critiques might be, hey, there have been long repeated calls for politics to be more diverse, and now it is. But it seems you're moving the goalposts. What you really want is diversity, but with your political agenda. How would you respond to that?
I think for me, I've always said, you know, when you vote in an election, you vote for the best person for the job. And on many cases, I mean, to give you a good example, Jeremy Corbyn, you know, he's a white male, but he resonated very strongly with the British Muslim community. And that's because he's always supported and advocated for policies that British Muslims support on issues like Palestine, on the Iraq War. And that's the point, isn't it? It's not just about your background. It's about what you stand for and what you believe in. Of course, I think diversity is a good thing. But I think true diversity is not just about where you come from. It's about where you want to take the country.
Taj Ali is a writer and political activist, speaking with us from his home in Luton, just north of London, about the diversity in cabinet choices made by the new UK Prime Minister, Liz Truss. Taj, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Speaking of London...
Watch the gap between the train and the platform.
This is Paddington.
London's transport system is bracing for hundreds of thousands of passengers this week who will pay their respects to Queen Elizabeth II. All weekend following the announcement of the Queen's death, crowds gathered at Buckingham Palace.
Still here outside the gates of Buckingham Palace, thousands of people still streaming past, paying their tributes. They've got a bit of a one-way system going.
Between all the flowers, messages, and assorted keepsakes left at the palace, BBC Television had to carry this announcement from the Royal Parks this morning.
They are suggesting that there are enough Paddingtons and marmalade sandwiches in the parks at the moment. So please feel free to bring flowers, but maybe don't bring any more Paddingtons.
Yep, no more stuffies. The Queen famously shared tea with the beloved toy bear, Paddington, for a video last year. The outpouring of feelings for the Queen is expected to cause a massive logistical challenge when her coffin arrives in London tomorrow night. That's according to BBC Radio's 5 Live.
Anyone wanting to pay their respects to the Queen in London is being warned that the queues to see the coffin could be up to 5 miles long. She will lie in state at Westminster Hall for 5 days.
Viewing of the Queen's coffin will begin Wednesday at 5 p.m. and continue 24 hours a day until just before sunrise on Monday, the day of her funeral. British authorities put out an announcement today that they had decided that insufficient deployment of police personnel is possible. They will definitely have their hands full. Still, Stuart Cundy of London's Metropolitan Police said that officers will be in place to keep a safe and secure environment all week.
We know that not just the eyes of the United Kingdom, but the world will be on London at this point in time.
But be prepared for lots of traffic, and don't even think about driving to the funeral. In fact, that's an order. British government guidance leaked yesterday said world leaders have been told they cannot use their own cars to attend the Queen's funeral. Instead, they'll be bused together from a site in West London. Tensions are easing between the world's two most populous countries, China and India. Both have pulled troops back from disputed territory along their common border, high up in the Himalayas. For more than 2 years, Chinese and Indian soldiers have been locked in a high-altitude face-off. At times, it became bloody. Today, though, both sides fully withdrew their forces, though the world's Patrick Nguyen says the dispute is not over. Patrick, first of all, why did China and India agree to pull troops back?
Well, it didn't come out of nowhere, Marco. Both sides have been holding talks this year, not so much to decide who owns the disputed land, but just to end the standoff. These disputed pockets of land are more than 15,000 feet above sea level around Tibet and Kashmir. And for 2 years, thousands of soldiers have been staring each other down in the freezing cold. Both sides agree not to bring their weapons up there to prevent all-out battles, but the soldiers have gotten into bloody brawls with stones and clubs. So it's obviously a situation that could lead to something more dangerous. The de-escalation is coming now because later this week, Xi Jinping and Narendra Modi, the leaders of China and India, will both be in the same room for the first time since it all kicked off. They're both going to be at a summit in Uzbekistan, and they may sit down and talk at that summit.
So how much bad blood has this border dispute created?
It's gotten pretty bad. It has really inflamed nationalism in both countries. Every so often, soldiers will leak a video of fights between the two countries, like this shoving match from 2 years ago.
Doing it. No, you are doing it. You are pushing. We are not to go ahead. Let's go.
You can hear the soldiers, Marco, saying, "You're pushing me. No, you're pushing me." As I said, neither side brings their guns up there. So you have this surreal dynamic where soldiers from two nuclear-armed militaries get into these schoolyard-style fights where they are all in parkas and clobbering each other in the snow. 2 years ago saw the worst melee up there with a few dozen deaths, and that upset the Indian government so much that they banned TikTok, which is Chinese-owned, and it's actually still banned till today.
So does this pullback of troops, does it bring China and India any closer to resolving who owns a territory? I mean, can they dial down the overall tension?
Yeah, it lowers the temperature so those conversations can at least take place. Both sides did release these coordinated statements saying, "We are not going to give up any of our territory. We are very firm on this." So it's not settled by any means. But if you look at Chinese state media, they are saying quite directly that if India and China can get along in other arenas like trade or diplomacy, that this border dispute will be easier to overlook. And after all, look, it is not prime real estate. We're talking about small pockets of territory that are under sub-zero temperatures, so high up in the mountains that they're basically inhospitable to humans.
Yes. So final question, Patrick, why does each side want it so bad?
These border disputes are ongoing from the mid-20th century, back when India was first becoming a nation, back when China was first becoming a communist nation, and they flared off and on over the years. So it's a long-standing border dispute that for most decades since then has been fairly cool. It really popped off semi-recently when India declared Kashmir, which is right on that border, as fully under the Indian government's rule. They sent a lot of soldiers up there. China responded by sending soldiers, and then the border conflict just got inflamed all over again.
There was Patrick Wynn with the latest news on the border dispute between China and India. For now, anyway, the two sides not playing stare down. That's a glimmer of good news. Patrick, thank you very much.
Thanks, Marco.
The school year has begun with a critical shortage of teachers in many parts of the U.S. The problem is especially acute when it comes to bilingual educators. It's estimated that there are more than 5 million children in the U.S. with limited English proficiency. So school teachers, school leaders are having to get creative. Brenda Leon with Connecticut Public Radio reports on how one district is recruiting from as far away as Puerto Rico.
Inside Michael D. Fox Elementary School in Hartford, Connecticut, Ms. Adriana Beltran Rodriguez's classroom is decorated with a large, colorful poster on the wall with the word hello.
Part of why I made this poster here, so that it's saying hello in every language spoken in the district.
That's 75 languages, making Hartford one of the most diverse school districts in the state. Beltran Rodriguez provides extra classroom support to students who have recently arrived from countries like Brazil and El Salvador. That's one in every five students. A native of Puerto Rico, she's a recent arrival herself. Beltran Rodriguez was recruited from the University of Puerto Rico at Río Piedras, even before she graduated. Moving to the U.S. wasn't a hard decision, after witnessing her own high school teachers who in their 30s were still living with their parents. Island living is expensive, while the salaries of civil servants have mostly been unchanged for the past 13 years.
In Puerto Rico, like, there's so many wonderful things about it. But the truth is, for teachers, it's a really hard time.
In Hartford, Beltran Rodriguez says she's able to afford her own apartment with a teacher salary, something unheard of back on her island. Leslie Torres Rodriguez, the superintendent at the Hartford Public School District, says with teachers retiring and fewer students entering the teaching profession in the U.S., it just made sense to look to Puerto Rico for teachers.
Since 2010, enrollment nationally in teacher prep programs has declined by a third.
The district worked closely with Daniel Diaz, a consultant who's been recruiting teachers from Puerto Rico for 15 years. He says the greatest advantage is their citizenship status.
The teachers in Puerto Rico are American citizens, so we don't have to go through the J-1 visa. The teachers from Puerto Rico, they come here to stay.
The Connecticut recruitment pilot programs worked so well that last March, the school district returned to the island to hire more bilingual teachers. But Professor Carmen Bellido at the University of Puerto Rico in Mayagüez worries that as more teachers leave for the higher pay and opportunities in the state, it's led to a brain drain. And Bellido says fewer students are going into the education field. Since Hurricane Maria hit the island in 2017, followed by a devastating earthquake, Puerto Rico officials say school enrollment has fallen 31%. College enrollment has also dropped.
So hopefully we'll be able to create our own classroom handshake.
This week was the first week of class for Marcos Gabriel Valentin Ortiz at Weaver High School. The 33-year-old was among those who said would never leave Puerto Rico. But after an offer to more than triple his salary, help with housing, and a signing bonus, he was one of 16 teachers who accepted the district's offer.
Starting Weaver has been a challenge because of all the, you know, new process of how things are done in this school or culture, getting to know the curriculum, getting to know the students in a different culture. So my first day was like a shock.
He's working with second and third generation Puerto Rican students, but even that's been a challenge.
Trying to communicate with them the culture that I think is Puerto Rican is not like I thought. They don't know the Puerto Rico that I know, actually.
Even with just a week under his belt, Valentin Ortiz says he made the right decision. Valentin Ortiz misses home, his friends, and the grandfather who raised him. But he says this is his time to grow.
Still adapting, still learning a lot. That's one of the things that I want. Learn new things, have an adventure. Hopefully I survive that adventure by the end of the year.
But his first priority, he says, are his students. For The World, I'm Brenda Leon in Hartford, Connecticut.
Brenda's story is part of our series On Course, Exploring Immigration and Higher Education. Check out more of the reporting on our website, U.S. Educators Helping Displaced Ukrainians Continue Their Studies, and Mexican citizens who return to Mexico only to face difficulties pursuing their degrees. Look for the series On Course on our website, theworld.org. When the far-flung members of the band Super Organism completed their first album in 2018, they had never even been in the same room together. Such is the power of tech communication today. Lead singer Orono Noguchi splits her time between Phoenix and Tokyo. The other members hail from the U.S., the U.K., Australia, and South Korea. Much of Super Organism's latest recording was also done remotely. It doesn't seem to have diluted the spirit and energy of the band when you hear songs like On and On. For a group that leans heavily on technology to get the job done, they're also keenly aware of the pitfalls. On Super Organism's latest album, Worldwide Pop, there's a song called Put Down Your Phone. Its message is pretty clear. This track, On and On, also bemoans the incessant chatter and clatter brought on by technology, whether it's a 24/7 news cycle or the endless ricochet of opinions on social media. As Orono sings, is it now the normal way? Reasons out, just hope and pray, and switch off till it goes away. Pretty deep stuff, and it's bubblegum catchy. That's where we wrap things up today. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Marco Werman. Thanks for making it today. Hope to see you right back here tomorrow.